Chapter 6. Judaleon se dio a permutaciones de letras y a complejas variaciones, y al fin pronunció el nombre que es la clave, la puerta, el eco, el huésped y el palacio. Jorge Luis Borges, El Golem. And then, in a fit of hate, as I worked again at the Bulafia's obtuse question, "Do you have the password?" I typed, "No." The screen began to fill with words, lines, codes, a flood of communication. I had broken into a Bulafia. Thrilled by my triumph, I didn't ask myself why Belbo had chosen that, of all words. Now I know, and I know, too, that in a moment of lucidity he understood what I have come to understand only now. But last Thursday my only thought was that I had won. I danced, clapped my hands, sang an old army song. Then I went to the bathroom and washed my face. When I came back, I began printing out the files, last files first, what Belbo had written just before his flight to Paris. As the printer chattered implacably, I devoured some food and drank some more whiskey. When the printer stopped and I read what Belbo had written, I was aghast, unable to decide whether this was an extraordinary revelation or the wild raving of a madman. What did I really know about Jacopo Belbo? What had I learned about him in the 2 years I worked at his side almost every day? How much faith could I put in the word of a man who, by his own admission, was writing under exceptional circumstances, in a fog of alcohol, tobacco, and terror, completely cut off from the world for 3 days? It was already night, Thursday, June 21st. My eyes were watering. I had been staring at the screen and then at the printer's pointless anthill since morning. What I had read might be true or might be false, but Belbo said he would call in the morning. I would have to wait here. My head swam. I staggered into the bedroom and fell, still dressed, onto the unmade bed. At around 8, I woke from a deep, sticky sleep, not realizing at first where I was. Luckily, I found a can of coffee and was able to make myself a few cups. The phone didn't ring. I didn't dare go out to buy anything because Belbo might call while I was gone. I went back to the machine and began printing out the other disks in chronological order. I found games, exercises, and accounts of events I knew about, but told from Belbo's private point of view, so that they were reshaped and appeared to me now in a different light. I found diary fragments, confessions, outlines for works of fiction made with the bitter obstinacy of a man who knows that his efforts are doomed to failure. I found descriptions of people I remembered, but now I saw them with different faces, sinister faces, unless this was because I was seeing them as part of a horrible final mosaic. And I found a file devoted entirely to quotations taken from Belbo's most recent reading. I recognized them immediately. Together we had pored over so many texts during those months. The quotations were numbered, 120 in all. The number was probably a deliberate choice. If not, the coincidence was disturbing. But why those passages and not others? Today I reinterpret Belbo's files, the whole story they tell, in the light of that quotation file. I tell the passages like the beads of a heretical rosary. For Belbo, some of them may have been an alarm, a hope of rescue. Or am I, too, no longer able to distinguish common sense from unmoored meaning? I try to convince myself that my reinterpretation is correct, but as recently as this morning someone told me, not Belbo, that I was mad. On the horizon, beyond the Brico, the moon is slowly rising. This big house is filled with strange rustling sounds, termites, perhaps, mice, or the ghost of Adelino Canepa. I dare not walk along the hall. I stay in Uncle Carlo's study and look out the window. From time to time I step onto the terrace to see if anyone is coming up the hill. I feel that I'm in a movie. How pathetic. Here come the bad guys. Yet the hill is so calm tonight, a summer night now. Adventurous, dubious, and demented were the events I reconstructed to pass the time and to keep up my spirits as I stood waiting in the periscope 2 nights ago, between 5 and 10 o'clock, moving my legs as if to some Afro-Brazilian beat to help the blood circulate. I thought back over the last few years, abandoning myself to the magic role of the atabax, accepting the revelation that our fantasies, begun as a mechanical ballet, were about to be transformed in this temple of things mechanical into right, possession, apparition, and the dominion of Exu. In the periscope, I had no proof that what I had learned from the printout was true. I could still take refuge in doubt. At midnight, perhaps, I would discover that I had come to Paris and hidden myself like a thief in a harmless museum of technology, only because I had foolishly fallen into a macumba staged for credulous tourists, letting myself be hypnotized by the perfumadors and the rhythm of the pontos. As I recomposed the mosaic, my mood changed from disenchantment to pity to suspicion, and I wished that now I could rid myself of this present lucidity and recover that same vacillation between mystic illusion and the presentiment of a trap. Recover what I thought then as I mulled over the documents I had read so frantically the day before and reread that morning at the airport and during the flight to Paris. How irresponsibly Belbo, Diotelevi, and I had rewritten the world, or, as Diotelevi would have put it, had rediscovered what in the book had been engraved at white heat between the black lines formed by the letters, like black insects that supposedly made the Torah clear. And now, 2 days later, having achieved, I hope, serenity and amor fati, I can tell the story I reconstructed so anxiously, hoping it was false, inside the periscope, the story I had read 2 days ago in Belbo's apartment, the story I had lived for 12 years between Pilate's whiskey and the dust of Garamond Press.